Whenever you're ready. Julie, are you ready?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay.
All right. So I guess I'll take it away with our first article here. So this is a paper that was in AJSP, and many of you on this meeting, I think, are authors of it. It's several folks from the Scottsdale and Rochester campuses, as well as Christoph Frohn. Dr. Hartazilar is the last author. And this article really focuses on LIP, what defines it, and the clinical correlates of it. LIP was one of the original classes of interstitial lung disease back from Liebau in 1969. But since then, there have been a lot of changes in how we classify ILD, with cellular NSIP being an entity, and with better ways to identify lymphomas, and with fewer patients with AIDS. So altogether, the actual diagnosis of LIP has become quite rare, and the authors wanted to revisit the utility of continuing to do so. One of the more recent looks at LIP as a definition was by the ATS classification from 2013, was the most recent one. And they have a table here that summarizes those classifications. Generally, it was you need expansile interstitial lymphoid proliferations, and you had to exclude a few other things like really marked organizing pneumonia or features that might make you think of a lymphoma. So it was supposed to be like not tracking along lymphovascular bundles and not showing kappa or lambda restriction. Which is a fairly narrow definition of LIP compared to all of the different ways where you can have lymphoid-rich infiltrates in a lung. The other thing the ATS classification did was define a radiologic LIP in contrast to the pathologic one. And though in the actual ATS definition, it's not necessarily cystic, in practice, radiologists generally consider cysts pretty pathognomonic for a radiologic LIP picture. So the author's goal here was to look at cases in hindsight that were diagnosed as pathologic LIP or radiologic LIP or anything else kind of in that spectrum of morphology and see how it correlates with the clinical outcome and correlate the pathologic and the radiologic ones to see if they were finding the same cases. So in their review, they found 201 cases. These were mostly consult cases, so they had information from the consult, but weren't necessarily able to go back to the history itself for further detail. They included anything that sounded like had lots of rich lymphoid infiltrates. They threw in lots of different buzzwords of different ways that might be described, but ultimately on their review, they reclassified these as having diffuse expansile lymphoid infiltrates, or DELI, you might see that term in their paper, follicular hyperplasia, or multinodular lymphocytic hyperplasia, or some combination of those things. they also included anything that was connective tissue disease associated and had cysts on imaging to make sure they had captured enough of the radiologic LIPs. So in terms of those methods, I think we're good. We can go on to their results. And I can say there's a table down there eventually that will have the correlations between these etiologies and the different classifications. So this is using the ATS criteria. And there's generally three etiologies. It's either autoimmune or immune deficiency or amyotrophic toxicity. All of those are represented within the pathologic LIPs. But interesting, the radiologic LIPs were only autoimmune disorders or a few just like couldn't classify because there was insufficient information. So already you're seeing a bit of a difference in radiologics are just autoimmune in your differential. Pathologic LIPs have a broader differential. So looking like these may not identify the same cases. And Dr. Bolin, if you're able to scroll down to the Venn diagram, when they started categorizing how these really look, there's a huge amount of overlap in the different histologic patterns, and the radiologic ones didn't really overlap very much with the pathologic LIP, which are in gray, and the radiologic are the ones in green there. So not really the same thing under our microscopes. A few other analyses that they did was sorting out if each of those three bubbles, which are diffuse expansile or follicular bronchiolitis or multinodular hyperplasia, if you look at those separately, do those patterns correlate any better with etiology than using the pathologic LIP definition from ATS? And their answer was no, that you still get all three possible etiologies in each of those other sort of more descriptive morphologic subtypes. They also had a look at whether particular cellular elements might correlate better with etiology. And they did find that having very few lymphocytes or non-necrotizing granulomas or some organizing pneumonia might sway you to be more in the immunodeficiency category, but it wasn't an absolute. There was still some autoimmune that had those features. So you might maybe in your comment favor immune deficiency more if you see those things. And that's kind of in keeping with the idea of GLILD or the granulomatous lymphocytic interstitial lung disease having the combination of granulomas and lymphocytes. They have a note in their discussion that there is overlap in what we see in GLILD and LIP in keeping with both of them being potentially associated with immunodeficiency, but that there are also lots of immune deficiency cases that just show more granulomatous inflammation and don't really show anything in the spectrum of LIP. The final thing that they mentioned in their results is that there was a fair number of cases that had lymphomas, and that in many cases, the areas that on immunostains you could recognize as lymphoma looked very much similar to areas that were not lymphoma when you immunostain them. So it raises caution on these cases to even in multiple areas do stains to try and sort out if there's an element of molt lymphoma hiding there. This table here has the percentages. It was between 3% and about 20% of cases in each of these morphologic categories that ended up having some lymphoma associated with them. So you can't exclude lymphoma just by the pattern of lymphocytic infiltrates. Ultimately then, the conclusion from the authors really raises into question whether we should still use the term LIP, whether it's really useful. I put in our little summary how they phrased it for us. Let me just look it up and I'll read it to you. They say the data raises concerns about the practical use of the term LIP as currently defined, and they say it does not present with sufficiently distinct findings to delineate such cases from other patterns of diffuse benign lymphoid proliferations. We believe LIP should be abandoned as a pathologic and radiologic diagnosis, which is a pretty explicit statement that they want to get rid of this term. they say instead to maybe instead report our cases as either diffuse expansive lymphoid infiltrates, follicular bronchiolitis, or multinodular lymphoid hyperplasia, because then at least the reader knows exactly what it looks like and you can put in a combination of those different things because they are often seen in combination. It seems to me like from their data, it's not like pathologic LIP is any more specific or sensitive for any particular etiology than these other terms, but it does have the problem that when you say pathologic LIP, clinicians might confuse that with radiologic LIP and might not really know what to expect on imaging, how that should correlate with the imaging. So it's a bit more complicated than just describing what we see. I think that's the main take home then, is to just stir up some interest in maybe changing the terminology we use for these cases. And I'd be really curious what the group thinks about the continued use of LIP.
Thanks, Julia. Great job.
Yeah,
any comments, questions from the group or from some of the authors of the paper?
Well, I thought this was great in the sense that it really illustrates that most things that have been called LIP for years aren't. And that certainly kind of reached epidemic proportions with AIDS. Everything with lymphocytes was called LIP. And we've been telling our radiology colleagues here for a long time that their diagnosis of LIP bears almost no relationship with the histologic diagnosis. But I was curious because there's some suggestion in the literature, and I think it's been our anecdotal experience, that when they see cysts in the right context, it's almost always a clonal lesion, frequently with associated amyloid or non-amyloid light chain. Did these authors comment on that?
Sorry, regarding whether cystic
change in radiology predicts for clonal proliferations with amyloid or non-amyloid light chain deposition.
Oh, interesting. I remember from their table that it was still that sort of about 10 to 20% instance of any lymphoproliferative, but I don't know the amyloid and the other features of it, if that was
related.
Yeah, good question.
Cystic cases of radiologic LIP.
So in the Sjogren's literature, for example, it's shown that cystic change is statistically associated with clonal lymphoproliferative lesions, i.e. malt lymphoma. And I just wondered if there were any signals in this group of patients that would address that.
Mm-hmm. Good question. I don't recall a mention of that in particular, but yeah, that is a good question.
Yeah, because it looks like this part of the table is cystic LIP or radiographic LIP, and it looks like here's the MALT lymphomas have some, but still have lots of patterns that aren't lymphoma, it looks like. Go ahead, Henry.
Jeff? Yeah, thanks. Maybe that's a good observation. Maybe that's partly biased based on how we found the cases. Yeah. So that's my only explanation maybe for that. I mean, I think there was overlap, but it wasn't like all the cystic cases had lymphoma or light chain or amyloid.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. What do you think about getting rid of the term LIP? And I'll just tell you, as one of the authors, we had a lot of debate about how far we should go down that road. And, you know, you can see where we ended up. Although, like I said, we had a lot of debate about whether we should just say, well, expand the ATS definition to include these other patterns or get rid of the term altogether. And we sort of landed at the provocative place that we did, but I'd be curious about what people think.
I think it makes the point that we should quit using it when it isn't true. And we've been doing that for a long time. And maybe these other terms are better terms when it's not true. But many of the things that you have on your Venn diagram just aren't LIP. And I agree that it's stupid to call them LIP if they're not. But, I don't know that these terms are any better in terms of communicating significance. But, I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks.
We have an esteemed visitor. I'd be curious in her opinion.
The busy professor. Just be quiet in the background. I have to say, I never find a case where it looks that LIP in my mind looks like what's on the slide.
Exactly.
So I hardly ever make that diagnosis, because then I end up either, well, it looks more like an SIP, or, you know, there's follicles and it's a little more nodular. So, yeah. But I think Joanne, she's not saying anything, but Joanne sometimes will show me cases or I'll see cases in teaching files. And I think she was already embracing LIP having kind of multiple patterns of lymphoid hyperplasia, which I thought was, why not? I mean, you're trying to, by your diagnosis, point in a direction of etiology potentially. They pretty much all point towards autoimmune, whatever. And that's what you want your clinicians to look for if the patient doesn't have the history, and you want to make sure you're not missing lymphoma. So.
And Andrew Nixon was writing about that 2 decades ago, right? Saying that follicular bronchiolitis and LIP are two extremes.
Of the same.
And in the middle is a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Right? That isn't LIP.
Exactly.
And I think this is saying it in a different
exactly.
way.
Exactly. So I like that direction.
If I kind of add what the MC said, is that, you know, the most of the at least a good portion of the LIP that Dr. Lebo described is probably a lymphoma. What is in my head is, you know, the like a little more severe form of cellular NSIP that you start to worry about lymphoma is LIP. That's in my head. But that's totally, you know, dissociated with the radiologic LIP. So what is really confusing us, you know, in a way, the morphology, we can kind of make a spectrum and everything that makes sense. You know, many of them are associated with the Sjogren's or some immune deficiency or kind of immune disorders. But that cystic change that we never see in our pathologic LIP, that's the, you know, kind of a wild card that is out there that confuses everybody, actually, you know, because when we say LIP, well, there's no cystic change, so it's not LIP. That's what radiologists said. But what we are seeing is, you know, it's a really diffuse lymphocytic infiltrates that is not lymphoma, but it's like a beyond whatever we can, you know, stretch from the cellular NSIP. So that's in my head, and all the spectrum, I think that's the best category. But if you want to ditch the word in a category LIP, I'm okay with it, though.
But I think your point about the radiology is really important, because I think it has a lot from which we can learn. The myth that radiologists can diagnose LIP was based on very, very low quality anecdotal data. But the consequence for MDD was that if enough people keep saying it's true, we all believe that it's true, but it's not true and it's never been true. And and the same thing is now happening with hypersensitivity pneumonitis. So, I mean, we're all to blame.
Yeah, I always feel good because, you know, when LIP is on the differential diagnosis of some cystic lung disease, I can say, well, it's not that really fast because there's not a lick of lymphocytes anywhere. It's something I can check off the list. Now we can move on to the other more likely things. All right, great discussion. I think we will move on for the interest of time. Jackie, are you ready for your article? Sorry, Jackie, if you're talking, I can't hear you. And it doesn't look like you're muted. Okay, so maybe I'll do one of mine. Jackie, you see if you can figure your audio out. If you can't, you can come here and present it from here if you'd like, from my office. Okay, let's do this one next then. All right, so this is from JTO. Interesting article from the IASLC Pathology Committee about providing more useful criteria to define morphologic features of invasion in non-mucinous adenocarcinoma with lipidic growth. So as we all know, the task of recognizing invasion in a lipidic pattern, tumor has gotten a lot more relevant since the T stage is now determined by our assessment of invasion. But as we all know, it's not as easy as it sounds. And I think even with our own colleagues in our own institutions, we see that there's variability in where we assign invasion. And a lot of times we may struggle with particular areas trying to decide if something is invasive or not. So the goal of this paper, I think, really was to try to provide more direction in this regard. So I'm sorry, my summary is a little bit wordy, but I was really trying to like wrap my brain around what they did. And I had to read this a few times to try to understand exactly what they did here. So here's kind of a graphical overview of the study that they did, and I'll kind of walk you through it. So the first thing they did was blinded review of 32 cases, which was one scan slide for each case by 22 pathologists. And then they had them assess for total tumor size, invasive size, and they had to mark the invasive area using one line. They then did a second cohort. And in the second cohort, they had a subset of cases, 9 of their 28 cases, where there was proven invasion clinically. So the patient had lymph node metastases in most cases. I think 8 of the cases have lymph node metastases and 1 there was just recurrence. And the other ones, they clinically were indefinite because the patients had quite a long follow-up and they never recurred. So they kind of used this group as the truth, if you will, or definite invasion in that group. And then they had 27 pathologists evaluate that, those cases. And again, recording total tumor size, invasive size, and they could mark up to 3 areas of invasion. So they were reviewed in a stepwise fashion. First, they just reviewed the H&E, and then they were able to also review an elastic stain and a CK7 to try to help with the assessment of invasion. And then at each step, the pathologist, so the H&E, the elastic stain, and the CK7, the pathologist had to score as invasive, not invasive, or don't know. So they could say that they didn't know. And they had to mark it with a digital ruler. So after they did these 2 steps, a committee of 10 people that were a subset of these folks who scored these cases were unblinded to the data, including the outcome data. So the invasion data, the clinically proven invasion, as well as what the other experts, how they scored these cases. And then they used something called a Delphi procedure, which I had to read about a few times. I'm still not sure I completely understand it, but the idea is, you unblind this, you are able to discuss and explain why, you know, one expert marked in areas of invasion and one didn't. And then you also are able to establish kind of this truth. So the clinically invasive cases, and then try to come up with things they may have missed or, and the thought is that through this discussion, you get closer and closer to the truth. So that's kind of how they move towards a correct answer. So they selected criteria for invasion. And then once they did that, and I'll walk you through what criteria they selected, they also did then a validation cohort, which was 43 images. So those were still images, those weren't scanned slides, to 10 pathologists. And then they asked those pathologists to assess for invasion, first using just their gut reaction, like looks invasive or doesn't look invasive. And then they had them go through the criteria that they established in, to see if improvement, there was improvement in agreement on invasion. So how did this work? So when they did their first assessment of invasion, they found that when they asked people to measure, let me just see here, just trying to find this figure. This figure is the one I wanted. Okay. So when they asked people to just measure tumor size, we're using a digital ruler that had really good agreement, as you might expect, with a coefficient of variation of only 7%. However, when you ask them to measure invasion, the coefficient of variation shot up to 54%. And they noted notable spatial differences in the areas and sizes of invasion designated. So as you can see, here's one particular or two particular tumors. And they just showed you where all these different pathologists measured their invasion. And you can see there is kind of a general trend towards the middle being more invasive, but you know, we have this little tiny measurement, and then we have this person measuring, you know, 12.4. So a little bit all over the place when, so I thought that these lines were actually quite interesting to look at where everybody marked invasion in these tumors. So there are a few things that they picked up on through their discussion that they talk quite a bit about in the paper. The first is alveolar collapse, or iatrogenic or surgical collapse, or atelectasis. It's just basically the tumor is squished, mechanically squished. And so they noted that, and I think a lot of us have picked up on this over the years, that if you have a lipidic pattern tumor that gets squished, then all of a sudden things can start to look like acini and papilla and maybe even micropapilla because you have these squished alveoli and you're cutting some of them potentially kind of in cross section. And they have those, the thickened septa that we often see in lipidic pattern adenocarcinomas as well. So that was one issue that they discussed. And they said that when they looked at tumors that had been fixed either through the airways or introduced with a syringe to actually fix the tissue from the inside, that some of this could be partially mitigated, but even with fixation methods like that before the tumor was cut, it did not completely mitigate the likelihood that they would get kind of squished. So they did comment about a few factors that were helpful to judge tumor as being collapsed. And one that they specifically talk about is this kind of parallel streaming of the alveoli. So that all alveoli seem to be squished in a parallel fashion, and that there's a transition then to the normal lung, and the normal lung is also squished in a parallel fashion, so that all of the artifact, the kind of the long axis of all the alveoli are going in one direction. The other thing that they found helpful was the presence of alveolar macrophages in the lumen of glandular spaces that you're considering that may be invasive. And they said this may be helpful, but they definitely had areas where it looked invasive, where you still had alveolar macrophages in the lumen of the airspace. So they said that was not a definite criteria. The other thing,
they were definitely wrong about whether they were invasive.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the specific thing that they talked about, the other big kind of topic that they talk about in this paper, and specifically what they talk about in the presence of these alveolar macrophages potentially not being or being present in spaces that are invasive, is this thing they call extensive epithelial proliferation, EEP. So basically, they were starting to see multi-layering of cells lining the alveolar spaces. And these areas of multi-layering often were associated with higher cytologic grade and were also often adjacent to areas that were obviously invasive. So they started really kind of focusing on this and talking about it a lot. And I think that one of the main points of this paper is that they basically think that that's probably a pattern of invasion, or at least an invasive clone of the tumor that's kind of extending out into the alveolar spaces. If you have more than two cell layers that have a higher cytologic grade compared to the lipidic pattern that is surrounding it. Other criteria for invasion were the obvious things that we all think about, like invasion of the pleura and vessels and airways and desmoplastic stromal reaction, and then also effacement of the alveolar architecture. So if you ask yourself, is there any way this could be alveolar parenchyma? And the answer is no, because the architecture is completely effaced, then that obviously should be considered invasion as well. So after they go through, where they went through all of this, their major criteria for invasion included altered alveolar architecture, this extensive epithelial proliferation that they describe with more than two cells lining the alveolar spaces, and desmoplasia. So they use that to kind of create this flow chart here. Let me see if I can find it for you. So they put together this flow chart basically for primary criteria for invasion. So the obvious things like invasion of the pleura or the blood vessel or airways, are there growth patterns that are just invasive, like solid micropapillary acinar? And of course, when we talk about papillary and acinar, this is where things get dicey. You know, what the second step, I think, can potentially be difficult to interpret sometimes. So, and then again, can the focus represent pre-existing alveolar architecture? If the answer is no, then it's invasion. And the caveat for that is that fibroelastatic scar, so those classic bland scars that we see often in the center of an adenocarcinoma, they did not count that as effacement of the alveolar architecture. Then they entered this extensive epithelial proliferation, so more than two cells lining the alveolar spaces, and then desmoplastic stroma or invasion of the alveolar interstitium. So these were kind of the primary criteria for invasion. And then they had other things that were helpful, but not a slam dunk, such as high-grade cytology that transitions from areas of invasion. So basically, when they did their validation, they had people say, look at the image and say, yes, invasion or not invasion. And then they had people go through this kind of flow chart more systematically to decide if they thought the focus was actually invasive or not. The other thing, they found a few things that were uninformative for assessing for invasion. Those included angulated glands. So angulated glands alone without desmoplasia were not very predictive. Again, often we get that alveolar septal thickening. And when you have collapse, glands can look angulated even though they're still smushed alveoli, I guess is the point. Mature fibrotic or fibroelastic scar, like we already mentioned, and then alveolar septal thickening. I think we can all appreciate, we see that all the time in adenocarcinoma, and it's not super helpful to indicate invasion. So after they basically asked people to use this diagnostic algorithm, so they had their 10 experts look at those images again and say invasive and not invasive for 43 images. So they agreed 80% of the time just using their gut reaction. And they improved to 84%. So not a huge improvement, but a little bit of improvement using these provided criteria. And it's interesting to me, I'm still not sure I completely understand. They had to exclude one observer to get those agreement results. So they said that was uninterpretable. They're uninterpretable results. So I'm not sure if they said they didn't know a lot or what the deal was, but they did have to exclude somebody to get those results. It's a dense read, I think. And it was a little hard for me to kind of walk through exactly what they did, but I mean, it's a valiant effort, right? I think we're all frustrated by the fact that there aren't more specific criteria for us to assess for invasion and how much inter-observer variability that we see. They tried to provide, I think, some objective criteria. I think they did even mention, though, that adding more criteria such as this extensive epithelial proliferation could actually confuse people more, but they did assign it as a as a an interesting finding and suggested that that should be included in areas of invasion. If you see this extensive epithelial proliferation, that's technically in the alveolar spaces, but it's more than two cell layers thick and has high-grade cytologic features. So I think that's kind of it in a nutshell. Any thoughts, comments?
I have a question, Jen. You said a lot and I might have missed it. Can you go back to the initial figure you showed with the measurements?
Yes, because, figure four.
Yeah, because that's the problem I have. It looks like the review, a lot of people measuring were either measuring across a scar or trying to avoid the scar.
Right.
Depending you want to include it or not. Was that addressed? Do you measure from one invasive area to another across a scar, or should you avoid the scar? Did they have any comments on that?
They basically had said that they don't think the scar is indicative of invasion in and of itself, and that it shouldn't necessarily be included if you don't think that it's invasion through the scar. Although I have to say, though, we all see those cases, right, where there's like one invasion focus over here, one here, and then maybe a trickle through. And if it is, I just measure across the thing because I think parsing that out gets a little bit too difficult.
And to your point, let's say you don't include the scar. There's really no tumor cells in the scar, but you have invasion on one end and invasion on the other. In the WHO, they say to measure their largest, or you could estimate a percentage. What did this paper, talk about that?
So they generally, I mean, they state that those are the two ways that you can come up with your invasive size, but that, you know, when they were asking people basically to lay a digital ruler, everybody had to lay at least one. So they were pretty much forcing people to put a linear measure down for this particular publication. But yes, sometimes it may be easier to say, well, I think it's 5% invasion, so I'm going to multiply that by my total tumor size and call it that. But this one, since they were, I think part of the point was to create figures like this, where we can see how variable people are. This is what they went with. So,
hey Jen, did they? And it didn't clear to me from the way they did the study, but I'm confused that we seem to be doubling down on something that isn't actually a problem, because all the literature I'm familiar with, and there may be lots I don't know. Small lung adenocarcinomas with a predominant lipidic component, how big the invasion is doesn't matter.
Yeah. And I think,
was there any conclusion they could draw from their data set that it mattered?
No. I mean, they have evidence that we are assigning different T stages. But I agree. I think if you read Alan Borzik's kind of original paper from a few years ago that described this, you know, kind of measurement of invasion, you get the more of the feeling from that paper that he was like, don't sweat it. You know, like if it's just a little bit, you probably don't need to worry too much because these patients all seem to do well. And now I think we started hyper-focusing on these, you know, the difference between 4 and 6 millimeters when, you know, the data is limited, I think, around that cutoff point, and it would be nice if we had more data there. But I know in our study we did a few years ago, those patients didn't do like suddenly worse. It wasn't anything magic about 5 millimeters. And I think the larger cohorts on lipidic predominant adenocarcinoma, the patients also do very well. So
yeah, Cadota's data from Memorial, where Bill Travis was a co-author, they had almost 500 patients. And even if they were lipidic predominant and it was at least 50%, more than 6 millimeters didn't matter. So I don't understand why we're obsessing about something that's not a problem. I mean, it just makes us look kind of stupid, right? I mean, if clinicians hear that we can't tell them how much is invasive, they just think we're incompetent. Like, where's your ruler? So I don't know. It just seems weird to me. I don't get it. Now we have an invasion working group.
I know.
And maybe to fire somebody to get statistically good data.
And maybe we just need to just like,
is anybody laughing?
Let the specific measurement part go, because we're apparently really bad on it. I think we're all much better at assigning a grade, you know, like in the three-tiered grading system, and saying, well, this is a well-differentiated lung cancer. I think everybody would agree on that when we only have 3 options in a nice 3-tiered system. But when you get this many like infinite options of just letting people lay down a line, it gets pretty challenging. All right, Jackie, do we have audio on you yet?
Is this working now?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, great.
Great. So I will, here we go. All right, go ahead, Jackie, take it away.
Okay, thanks so much. So I'm presenting this paper on how major pathological respawn exhibited distinct prognostic significance for lung adenocarcinoma post different modalities of neoadjuvant therapy. That's a mouthful. So a little bit of background, like major pathological response in post neoadjuvant non-small cell carcinoma is defined as less than 10% of residual viable tumor cells in the tumor bed, and is proposed as a predictor of survival and often used as a outcome endpoint in many clinical trials. And in this paper, the authors aim to assess the clinical significance of percent of residual viable tumor in the settings of neoadjuvant chemotherapy as well as neoadjuvant targeted therapy. So what they did was they did a retrospective review of 152 lung adenocarcinoma patients who were treated with either neoadjuvant chemotherapy or neoadjuvant EGFR targeted therapies. They reviewed the clinical pathologic characteristics, the treatment response, as well as the survival status of these patients. And the histologic characteristics were reviewed by two pathologists who were blinded to the patient outcomes. And what they found in the results was, well, first of all, 26 of the patients showed major pathologic response, which is about 17%. And analyzing these results, say in figure one, they analyze all the patients and comparing whether the major pathologic status would correlate with a significant different overall survival or a recurrence-free survival. So as you can see in the Kaplan-Meier curves here, on the left is the recurrence-free survival. It did not show us, the major pathologic response did not seem to stratify between the two groups of patients in terms of their recurrence-free survival. But in overall survival, there is a significant difference based on whether the patient has a major pathologic response or not. And from there, they wanted to see if there's a better cutoff point than just 10%. So they did basically a log rank statistic at every cutoff point in like 5% increments, and try to see which one results in the highest log rank, and chose that point as the cutoff point. And so, oh yeah, actually, can we go back to figure one a little
bit? Sure. Sorry, Jackie.
Sorry.
There you go.
So kind of in C and D here, it's kind of what they did to pick their cutoff point. So kind of like the dot plot in the bottom half of C kind of shows that like the highest log rank was at 0.7, i.e. 70% residual viable tumor. So they picked that as their optimal cutoff point. Similarly, in figure D, 70% was also the one with the highest log rank statistic. So they picked that as their optimal cutoff point. And using these, using 70% as the cutoff point for both recurrence-free survival and overall survival, as you can see in E and F, it did stratify the patient in a statistically significant way in terms of recurrence-free survival as well as overall survival. So there seemed to be like some use like in terms of when we readjust the cutoffs. And then next, they basically repeated a similar analysis in a subgroup of patients who received only a chemotherapy treatment. So that would be figure two. So in figure two here, they tried to reanalyze it, and they identified the kind of the optimal cutoff points as 60% for recurrence-free survival and 70% for overall survival. And using these cutoff points, they show that when we construct the Kaplan-Meier curves in C and D, there is a significant difference in terms of both recurrence-free survival and overall survival between patients above and below these cutoff points. And from there on, they were also interested in looking at other clinical pathologic characteristics to see if there's anything else that would help risk stratify these patients. So yeah, if we go to the next table, this one here. So looking at the chemotherapy treated patients only, when they performed univariate and multivariate analysis on these patients to see if any other variables would help risk stratify this patient, they found that, not really many other variables were helpful. Seems to be just the residual viable tumor percentage that was helpful. So they didn't really go further on from that in this chemotherapy cohort. And instead they went on to the targeted therapy cohort and repeated essentially the same analysis. But in this case, they identified 35% and 70% as their optimal cutoff points. However, using these cutoff points, there was no statistically significant differences in terms of recurrence-free survival or overall survival in these targeted therapy patients. So based on that, they once again went on to look at other clinical pathologic characteristics to see if any of those would be helpful for risk stratification. So from in that analysis for these patients, they identify the PN stage as well as the presence of high-grade patterns as a helpful variables in terms of risk stratifying these patients. The only thing though is that for their PN stage analysis, they compared N0 to N1 against N2, which is somewhat interesting, I guess, because you can also do like N0 versus N1 plus N2, but that's the choice here. So based on the fact that I identify PN and high-grade patterns as possibly useful prognostic factors, they constructed what they call a nomogram in figure 4A, near the bottom. Oh, actually, we just went past it.
Sorry. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no. It's,
there it is.
And thanks. And then, they call it a nomogram, but it doesn't seem to function like the typical ones I see. But it's more like a point scale. So for example, YPN stage, for example, if you're PN stage 1, they will assign a certain number of points. Like here will be 44 points. And then if you get absence of solid, you get 100 points. So if you basically add up the point totals for all these features and and go to the point scale near the bottom, draw a line to the 2-year no recurrence probability scale at the bottom, it gives you their predicted probability for 2-year no recurrence survival. So, and they evaluated this model and claimed that there is about 73% confidence in their accuracy. So it's not exactly amazing, but they seem happy with it as a preliminary. But kind of overall, the results in this study were somewhat in line with previous study that showed that a cutoff point of 60 to 65% residual viable tumor is more effective at predicting survival in these patients with adenocarcinoma who are treated with neoadjuvant therapies. And the data also reaffirms that there is significant prognostic value in high-grade patterns in non-small cell lung carcinoma. And really the overall take-home message here is that the residual viable tumor percentage is of prognostic value in patients with neoadjuvant chemotherapy-treated adenocarcinoma, but the 10% cutoff might be a little controversial. And as well, in the setting of a neoadjuvant of neoadjuvant targeted therapies, the presence of high-grade patterns and the PN stages are perhaps more useful prognostically than the major pathological response. So yeah, so that's all I have for this paper. Like, if anyone have any comments, questions, or like want to share their personal experience with like NPR, just let me know. Thanks.
Thanks, Jackie. Great job. I know we're seeing this more and more, so it'd be nice if we have more direct criteria for major pathological response. Any other thoughts or comments? I know we're at the top of the hour here.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
No, I'm sorry. I used this link for another Zoom meeting.
Oh,
so honestly.
Sorry, Anya. Sorry. Okay, I guess we're done.
Which I actually moved just 15 minutes later, but I guess
no
people are eager.
No worries.
I'm so sorry.
So I also have this this summary. If anybody cares to read it, I basically included it because I do have interest in bronchiolar adenomas and CMPTs. The upshot is about 20% were called malignant on frozen section, still, even though this has been a known entity. And they have a huge number of cases here. I think they have like over 200 with 150 with frozen section. Wow. And most of them are the distal type. So I think it is interesting. You know, I think what one person calls a distal bronchiolar adenoma, we may be running into things other people would call maybe florid peribronchiolar metaplasia or have another word for it. So I think it is kind of muddied the waters of this diagnosis a little bit because this was a 3-year cohort with 208. So clearly they're calling a lot of stuff. they're calling a lot of stuff, but I think the most important thing is that we're still, they make some points about overinterpretation of these types of lesions on frozen section and pitfalls there, which I think is worth a look. So thanks everybody for joining Journal Club today and have a great day.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you.
Thank you.